Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, joined, of course, by the dear leader of Danway.com, the one, the only, Jeremy Goldcorn. How the hell are you doing, Jeremy?
Good evening, Kaiser.
Well, it's good to see you, man. And we are continuing our summer break from the news-related topics we usually tackle here on Seneca and talking today about something that we don't discuss with nearly enough frequency on this show, the arts in China. We are absolutely delighted to have with us a woman who is better qualified than anyone else I know to talk about the arts, Ms. Allison Friedman. Allison is the director and founder of Ping Pong Productions, which is based right here in Beijing, and is involved in all sorts of aspects of performing arts, especially in cross-cultural exchange and bringing groups from the States over here and bringing groups performing artists from China to points beyond. How are you, Allison?
I'm good. Hi, Kaiser.
Well,
hi, Jeremy.
Welcome. Good to have you.
It's good to be here.
Welcome. Yeah.
Thank you.
So let's. I mean, for people who don't know you, I think everyone in Beijing basically does. But for people beyond, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got involved in the performing arts. I think that it had something to do with tap dance.
It did. I was curious whether you had a wooden floor in the pop-up studio and if I should bring my tap shoes to have some audio accompaniment. But it's carpeted, so yeah, I'm off
well,
the hook.
You know, we need to have like sound, you know, soft sounds in here.
Right, there you go. That's another story. But I actually did that once when I worked for CRI. Brought my tap shoes into the studio and tap danced for Beijing listening audiences.
Oh, that's awesome.
But yeah, my background in China. I've been here 12 years now, and tap dance was my entry-level drug to the world of dance.
Oh,
and
wow.
Back in the day, I thought, never the twain shall meet. I mean, how in those days do you combine an interest in dance and theater and playing piano like every nice young Jewish girl should do with an interest in studying Chinese? So,
which is something also every nice young Jewish girl should
it's
be.
It's true.
Indeed.
The lost tribe.
Actually, you started Chinese in high school, yeah. Right?
I did. You've had Bill Bishop on the show many a time, and we were actually xiaoyou. We went to the same high school in D.C., although I like to point out he's much older than I am.
Yeah.
Bill is ancient.
It's true.
Ancient,
it's,
right?
Yeah. Hey. Bill still is my didi. He's shuhou. I think he's a monkey.
Really?
A horse.
What shuhou?
So you're
people are revealing too much, as always, you Americans. You're
right.
Oversharing.
Right.
Yeah.
We're
yeah.
artists here. We're touchy feely. Come
okay,
on.
Okay.
That's right. I'm being an artist.
I'm including you in this, Kaiser.
And,
exactly.
Right,
come on.
Exactly.
Punk. You know, death metal is as artsy as it gets.
Exactly. So
dialing it back.
Yeah, dialing back and all coming right. back to
no, I did. I studied Chinese in high school. It seemed like a lark when you're 14, and that's an option. This is back in the day. I'm not that much younger than Bill Bishop, so this is back in the day
12
before
years
the rest of the world figured out they should study Chinese. And I stuck with it in college, still not knowing what I was going to do. I sort of felt my whole life was this battle between and versus or. You know, either you do Chinese or you do the arts, or you do academics or you do artsy-fartsy stuff. And I was always a champion for the and over the or.
I'm all about the and. Jeremy, don't you agree? You married an and. Oh, you actually got a red and or.
I used to be all about the esk, I would say. But,
ish, a little ish, a little esk. But so I still, you know, I was the typical lost soul. I went, and when I was thinking I'd go the journalism route, I thought that combined a lot of aspects. If you're on television, that's a little bit like performance, right? So I came and actually interned. It was Jimmy Floor Cruz's first week on the job at CNN, and interned. I got there 2 days before he arrived. And during that internship, I met a group called the Living Dance Studio, and they invited me to participate in a show they were doing with 30 Sichuan migrant workers. It was called Dance with Farm Workers, not to be confused with Dances with Wolves.
Oh my God.
and that blew it open for me. I mean, it was the classic story of the shared culture of modern dance. You know, here I was a college student, my Chinese was yi ban ban. We had a hard, awkward, you know, I was still the fat foreigner at that point. And the minute we started rehearsing, it was like I'd found family in China. So that blew it open for me that I could combine this performance background that I had with these years of painful study of Chinese.
How long ago did you start Ping Pong?
Ping Pong is almost 5 years old.
Oh, okay, great.
So it's still kind of the teenage years of a startup, I think you could call it.
Yeah, but I mean, you guys have done quite a number of you've brought over a number of pretty prominent performers and, you know, plays like the Pentagon Papers. What are some of the
Pentagon Papers, which what one wouldn't think would be a very easy type of play to bring to
especially at a very sensitive time.
You know, you're going to be in trouble with this one, and you pulled that off. That was. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, Ping Pong, the reason I started Ping Pong Productions, and it goes back to that performance with the migrant workers and the Living Dance Studio when I was still in college, this idea that, and again, it risks sounding cliched and cheesy, but this role of the arts as an ability to be a bridge between countries and cultures is very real. And even though I came back to China after college on a Fulbright fellowship to research contemporary performance, and one project led to another, and even though I liked working in the arts, what I really liked about it was how they could bring greater nuance to images of countries and cultures. You know, during that time in the early 2000s, everyone was paying attention to China. They'd just gotten the Olympic bid, but there was still that lack of understanding. So what the arts could do is bring them together, and Ping Pong's mission is cultural diplomacy. So this Pentagon Papers play is a great example of that. It's a docudrama written by Jeff Cowan. He's at USC, head of the Annenberg School, and the docudrama tells the story of when the U.S. government set an injunction against the Washington Post, or the New York Times, and then the Washington Post to not publish these documents.
Who plays Daniel Ellsberg in it?
We did the show. We actually toured it in 2011, and Josh Stamberg played. Ellsberg was played by Henry Clark, an actor in Hollywood.
Who I understand. Well, anyway, we're not going to overshare on. Anyway. Well, one of the things that we really want to talk to you about, something that you know quite a bit about, is the actual arts system here, the performing arts in China. I mean, the education system, the state companies like the Guotuan and so forth, how they're funded, and I don't know, it's something that a lot of people don't have exposure to. I myself, having lived here for an awfully long time, I still don't have all that much exposure to it. I mean, I've certainly known a lot of people who are involved in these state-run song and dance troupes and so forth, but give us a little bit of a sketch about how it's done here, or how it was done and how it's changed.
Sure. Yeah. Everything's en medias res. The performing arts groups in China, it's the same situation actually as other sectors. Everything was a state-owned enterprise once mm-hmm. upon a time. The song and dance troupes, the Guotuan, all of these massive theaters, they were all run, operated, supported by the government.
Right.
And the big shift came probably around 2005 with the 11th five-year plan, which set into motion the move from state-run, state-owned to more market-oriented systems for the arts groups. Just like they were shutting down factories, they were trying, or converting them, not necessarily shutting some down and trying to convert others. They were doing that with all of the arts organizations as well. So they basically said, you're a state-run song and dance troupe. Now you have to rely on market forces. Get thee to the marketplace.
Yeah.
And the one difficulty with that is there wasn't much of a marketplace for them to get thee to. Ticket buyers, you know, everyone expected, oh, Pong Yo Song Song Piao Ba, you know, give me a ticket, buddy. Give me free tickets.
We all know about that, right?
That's something my wife, who's a musician, complains about constantly in China, that if you are, you know, in the United States and you have a new CD or show, your friends will say, oh, where can I buy the CD, or where can I buy a ticket to the show? And in China, the first reaction is generally, oh, can you give me a CD, or can you give me tickets?
Right.
Exactly.
It does seem to be a sort of systemic and cultural problem.
Well, I remember when my old band was arrested on trumped-up drug-related charges.
As all good metal bands should be.
No, this is my old band, right.
Your old band.
My old band. Yeah. Basically, the stipulation for our release with a little slap on the wrist was, you need to get us tickets to every pop concert, you know, here for the next like 3 years or something. It was just crazy.
Kenny G, were you trying to hook him up with Kenny G, and then you'd be good to go?
Well, we that's where we brought Jeremy in, because Jeremy looks just like Kenny G. We just gave him an alto sax.
When you had longer hair.
Yeah. Soprano sax.
Dead ringer.
You've been mistaken for Kenny G in airports. Yeah, it's true. I'm
did you sign autographs?
So how did these guys fare? How did these, when they were tossed into the ocean, as it were, these song and dance troops? I mean, is it like the NEA, you know, getting defunded by Congress? Was it that kind of a thing?
It was a little bit of that. It's made it really rough for young, independent, more experimental people. On the one hand, you'd think, great, it's no longer state funded. That means it's going to be much less state controlled. And suddenly now there will be all this freedom and it will be a blossoming of groups. But in fact, in a lot of ways, the opposite sort of happened.
But there was no market to get thee to, right?
No market to get thee to. And all of a sudden, especially the venues. The venues became over-reliant on ticket sales.
Uh-huh.
Because to them, the market meant earned income. It meant people buying tickets. And to buy tickets, they needed headliners. They needed Kenny G. They needed other, you know, big names and
popular fare.
Popular fare, exactly. Or they needed things that brought mienzo, that brought face. So if a large, well-known orchestra was coming, that's not cheap, but it's distinguished. And then that could help them get more funding from the government. Because the government money didn't disappear. It was just getting reportioned and coming from different avenues.
And so has it been that way ever since 2005? I mean, have they languished in a sort of sorry state of affairs since 2005? Or have things improved in recent years at all?
A little bit of both. A good example is back to the Living Dance Studio. Uh-huh. In 2005, they went on this big tour of the U.S., and at that time, they did not want the Chinese embassy in the States to know they were going. They all went on tourist visas. They were worried that if the government knew, they might block their visas. There might be difficulties. Fast forward to 2011, there was a big China festival in Switzerland, and the Ministry of Culture paid for everybody, all the independent Chinese artists' airfare to go over and participate.
Mm.
And in 5 years, although within China it was getting a little rougher, they were changing policies to recognize that there were independent artists that were worthy of funding and support. Although the added difficulty is that support tends to be to send them out, not necessarily to support them within China.
So if
you need airfare to go to Europe, chances are that if the Ministry of Culture doesn't have certain problems with you, you can find that support. If it's funding, you know, systemic funding here in China to create new work, that doesn't exist yet. And that's still a really big problem.
So what do you think really needs to be done? It seems like that they didn't have a solution in place when they pulled the rug of support out from under and sort of cast them into the ocean.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. They I think thought that market forces would take over.
Right.
But the situation with the arts in every country is the market isn't necessarily what sustains it. That's why the American system has nonprofits, so people can donate to support something that maybe the market, you know, ticket sales wouldn't support. That's why Europe has government funding that does support things. And so there, it's sort of the pendulum swung one way to try and remove a lot of government funding, and now it's slowly inching back to figure out what kind is useful and what kind do they need.
And Alison, what do you think? Because that in some ways seems like it could be a good thing in the sense that you have now a lot of rich Chinese people, many of whom have already, you know, they've bought their Ferrari, you know, they've drunk Nyobi, they've acted like, you know, the bee's knees, to be polite, for long enough, and they want to fund the arts or culture. So I think you're starting to see a situation where you have funding. Will the government allow it without interference? Because and that, you know, harkens back a little bit to the question I asked you at the beginning about the Pentagon Papers. I mean, one of the big difficulties in the arts and culture here is that it's not just about funding. It's also about
content.
It's about
acceptability,
permissions.
History, permissions. And, you know, the Ministry of Culture and some of the other bodies that grant permission, especially for live performances, can be very, very interested in the details, shall we say.
Well, you touched on a lot of things there. In terms of the rise of corporate sponsorship or individual philanthropy, that's really the next horizon, and that's where we're starting to turn to right now. I mean, one of the reasons I've been here for 12 years is you really are seeing changes before your eyes. When I got here in 2002 on the Fulbright, the idea of a freelancer didn't really exist because if you weren't in an established company, there was no market, there were no projects going on for you to be a freelance dancer, theater artist, actor, writer, whatever. And now there are. I mean, the whole concept of Beipiao, Northern Floaters. Mm-hmm. There are all these artists in Beijing, the Beipiao. And I think that's one of the biggest changes you see. But going back to the funding issue.
Alison, that dates back, I think, to 1992, actually.
It's before it? That.
Even
I mean,
before, it's the 80s, is it?
It's the 80s. I mean, by the 80s, the scene back then was sort of this amalgam of people in the dramatic arts. You know, these are graduates of you know, and Xi Ji Xuan, you know, the Central Drama Academy and the film, right? And people from the art schools, but they didn't belong to it that way. I mean, it was just it was unheard of. They didn't have, you know, a dang hanging somewhere in some dangway. And they were independent, and we've seen this is very interesting. But they've been largely orphaned. They've been sort of left to their own devices, and there hasn't been any kind of government support for them. The ones who've gotten lucky, you know, have found art collectors or patrons or record labels or what have you.
But right, but who are you talking about? I mean, you guys are talking about music and visual arts.
Right.
Not theater and dance so much.
No, even theater and dance. I mean, theater, not so much. Yeah. Not dance. I'm admittedly completely unfamiliar with. But, you know, there was really one figure who kind of loomed large starting in the mid-90s, I guess, over the whole modern dance world. Kind of the way that Cui Jian kind of loomed large over the whole world of rock music, which I'm more familiar with. But, you know, Jin Xing.
Right. But she was part of a company.
She was part of a company, too.
She was part of a company. All of those people were part of companies. Jinxing, Beijing Modern Dance Company, was registered on the Beijing Ge Wu Tuan. And so they were zhuci, they were registered. And same with even Wu Wen. Well, Wu Wen Guang was different, but his wife, Wen Hui, who was the co-founder of the Living Dance Studio, Wen Hui was a choreographer with the Dongfang Ge Wu Tuan, the Oriental Song and Dance Troupe. Mm-hmm. And so that allowed them to then do all this stuff on the side. So directors like Lin Jiaohua, Meng Jinghui, they were all luminaries in these big government troops, and then found ways to walk that line to do everything on the side.
So they weren't freelancers, they were not the Bei Piao.
I mean, Wen Guang did his documentary Bumming in Beijing in the, what is that, the late 80s, early 90s?
Right, early 90s.
And that was about who you guys are talking about. But
actual dance people basically weren't being freelancers back then. You either had a danwei or you had shit.
Right, exactly. And in many ways, the danwei allowed you to do stuff
be.
On the
anyway,
side.
Yeah.
The danwei allowed you to bomb on the side.
Yeah,
that's very interesting.
I mean, which is a great. I mean, it's amazing. You know, the necessity is the mother of invention. So you find ways to. I mean, Wen Hui, whose work, a lot of her early work, I really respected, did one of the most ridiculous things that I. Least respect, where she did the Chinese imitation of river dance for the Dongfang Ge Wu Tuan, where they literally had the soundtrack of the river dance show complete with the Irish step dancing sounds in it, and they were just miming the tap dancing on stage.
Oh, good lord.
Oh, it was painful. I saw it at Poly Theater in 2004. It was killer. But
everybody makes mistakes.
Exactly. Well, you got to do what you
mistakes.
Do to survive.
Sometimes you got to do what you do to survive. Exactly.
Especially, but you were,
especially in Beijing.
So, I mean, so what are your hopes for?
You asked me about corporate sponsorship. Yeah. So this group, Tao Dance Theater, was invited to Lincoln Center Festival last year, and Bank of China sponsored it. Now, they didn't give the money to Tao Dance. They gave the money to Lincoln Center, but that allowed Lincoln Center to bring this independent dance company over, and Bank of China's, you know, logo was on everything.
Tell us about Tao Dance. I mean, we talked about the extraordinary figure at the center of that last time that we were chatting over beers. Tell us about.
Sure. Well, I where to start? I guess going back to this change that we're seeing now with more independent people finding ways to survive. You know, Wen Hui did it in the 90s and early 2000s by having a danwei and being able to fund stuff on the side through that. As well as with support from European foundations and things. But Tao Ye, who's the founder of Tao Dance, is the next generation. He's in his mid-20s. He's very young. He started the company 5 years ago when he was only like 22. And he went through the system. He was in an army song and dance troupe for a couple of years. Then he was in Jinxing's company in Shanghai. Then he was in the Beijing Modern Dance. And then he said, screw this. I have my own vision. I have my own direction. I'm leaving and I'm doing it myself, which meant he and one other dancer just left and started creating work. And there was no system, there was no income. They just lived frugally and traveled 3 hours a day to some region of Hebei to find a cheap 5-quiet-a-day rehearsal studio.
Wow.
And started creating work. And and one of the nice things I think about China is, for some of these artists, is the demand sometimes overwhelms supply. There aren't that many companies out there, but there's a lot of demand from European festivals, American festivals, you know, presenters who really want to show cutting edge, you know, finger quotes, art from China, performing arts from China. And if you've only got a handful of people to choose from, those people are going to be able to survive on a lot of international touring income. So that's a little bit how he got his start, but it's really snowballed. And they're now one of the few, they're not yet registered, they're entirely independent, but they have this gorgeous studio out in Shunyi that they've been able to fund entirely from international touring fees. They get nothing for survival from within China.
Wow.
They do get support for international airfares from the ministry, but that's it.
You told me once that there are more modern dance troops in the city of New York than there are in the entirety of China, this country of 1.39.
Exponentially
more.
Exponentially. There is a study done in 2006. This study said there were over almost 300 modern dance companies in the city of New York alone. In the city of New York alone, almost 300 dance companies. How many are in, Jerry, you know this already because I told you, Kaiser. Jeremy, how many would you venture to guess in all of China?
You're putting me on the spot.
Yeah, well, just throw out a number there,
Jeremy. How many modern dance companies in all of China? 50. No. 3.
Somewhere between that. Screw you.
Should I hedge my bets?
Now I see what kind of guy you are. Your second guess was closer.
It was much closer.
There's fewer than 10.
Fewer than 10. Oh, my God.
Right. And fully functioning, regularly functioning, regularly operating, performing groups.
Sure, but I mean, that doesn't surprise me because I remember when I first met Jin Xing in the 90s when she was running a club in Beijing. And
I remember that club.
About
Half
Dream, it was called.
Yeah. Half Dream, I remember that.
I mean, the feeling I had at the time was that, just the idea of modern dance was itself a breakthrough in China. It was one of those moments like the Stars art exhibition, outside the National Gallery in the late 70s. There was not the idea of modern dance really much before the 1990s. Yeah. So, I mean, it's not surprising that there's so few troops. I mean, but if you had to say how many dance troops are there in China...
That's another number.
There's more people than live in Manhattan, right?
Probably, exactly.
Yeah,
before the 11th five-year plan, the statistic for song and dance troops was in the almost 10,000. I mean,
every
province, Shengzhen...
Work units, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
And I have
there was
to
the
say...
the Shougang song and the Guotuan.
A lot of it is just, creates the most awful pabulum and bullshit. But I also have to say that a lot of the younger Chinese people I know who are doing interesting things culturally are like, Wenhua Guanardai. I mean, they are like cultural second-generation officials. Like, their parents are in, like... Go Wutuan of the military or, some stuff, where the state has supported arts. And it's not as bad as it can sound.
Well, half the
think.
Rock musicians are like that.
Yeah.
Seriously, they all come from, like, their parents
the
were all in Go Wutuan and stuff like that.
Filmmakers, rock musicians.
Right. Yeah. Are you seeing much by way of successful fusions between sort of traditional modern performing arts and... traditional and modern performing arts, or are we ending up with stuff like the 12 Girls Band?
Yeah, there's a lot of hip hop with shui xiu or something.
Shui xiu, long silk sleeves that were.
I think there's nothing. I don't know, people, and I get this a lot because one of the things Ping Pong does is bring Chinese groups out, and you get just the most excruciating, simplified. Oh, contemporary Chinese art must have influences from Tai Chi Chuan. And it must have influences from Peking opera and
calligraphy.
Yeah, exactly.
Guanxi.
Oh, it's magnetic poetry. Put all these words in a hat and shake them up. And it's not that way. I mean, that's one of the reasons Tao Dance Theater is so spectacular. Is it's just this individual's vision. It's one guy's idea. It's so clear what his focus is, and he's not drawing on ancient fill in the blank for Mad Libs Chinese. He's got one thing that he wants to do, and he's doing it to the end. And he's not kind of saying, "Well, this Coke can represents modernity, and this fan represents tradition, and here's my dance."
I've seen that one.
We all have too many times, and so what? And I think that's what modernity is. I mean, not to get too academic, but when you start talking about what is modern Chinese performance, it's about some one person's clarity of expression and what they have to say that's different than what someone else has to say, and whether they use shui xiu, silk sleeves to do that, or whether they use something really abstract that doesn't necessarily have a China title on it.
Jeremy, you know about my favorite coinage of my own, mixed struggle art.
Yes,
right? That's exactly what I'm talking. I mean, that's
exactly
what you're talking
about. I've
heard
about mixed struggle many times.
Right,
yeah.
That's right. It's that execrable.
The cheesy adoption of Chinese themes, whether they be traditional or revolutionary.
Yeah, it's revolutionary usually, and then pop culture or pop art kind of fusion. What's that guy's name?
Yes, the poor guy.
Yeah, the poor guy.
Which impresses people unfamiliar with China, but gets very stale very quickly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, I hear you.
So what are the difficulties that overseas companies and performers that they face when they come to China tour? I imagine that you must have a huge storehouse of humorous episodes that you could recount for our readers about, you know, foreign troops that come here.
The foreign troops that come to China to perform, my God, where to start? My favorite is when one troop showed up, and you know, China's building these gorgeous venues with world-renowned architects, and they're funding the buildings, but they're not funding the people to run them. And so we've shown up and had spectacular equipment still in the plastic, and no one in the building knows how to use it. The Mark Morris dance group from New York was coming, and months in advance, I'd been chasing them to get all the tech stuff ready. And the venue had said, yeah, we've got it, no problem. They're about to come, they're getting on the plane, and they get the information that, oh, all those lights you needed, we don't have those. And so these are boring stories. Hold on, let me think of a better one.
You know what? Don't self-correct. That I think actually says everything about the performing arts in China in a way right now, is that you do have these problems. It's not just the performing arts, it's also broadcast TV and, you know, to an extent all other kinds of media. But the performing arts, I think, is where it really hits, is you have the infrastructure and nothing in it.
That's
the problem. So I don't think you should try and force us to edit out that comment. I think you actually had
That's very typical. I mean, I've seen that happen a lot of times with bands that have come over here. You have this, you know, we're going to fax you all the back line. We have this, you know, all. But what about the guy who actually operates it? It's always the case. I mean, China has the hardware and often not the software.
Right, exactly. Well, and also they're trying to play both sides. They're trying to say they're next leaders in the cultural realm, and yet, oh, but we're still a poor developing country, so you should fund everything. So these big orchestras that are coming over are all funded by European governments, and the venues like the National Center for the Performing Arts still don't pay reasonable performance fees for the artists that come in.
Yeah,
so they still want everyone else to Maidan. They want the foreigners to pick up the bill.
So what is the state of cultural exchange between, okay, let's say, compare the EU and China with, say, the US and China? You know, once in a while we're treated to, you know, great things like what the Asian Society did the last couple of years, you know, bringing, you know, leading American artists from a whole bunch of disparate fields to China and having sort of meaningful exchanges with leading figures in the cultural world here in the mainland.
What's the U.S. doing?
Yeah, what are we doing?
Well, the U.S., Jeremy, you like to whine and complain about China a lot. I like to whine and complain about the U.S. a lot because we don't have a Ministry of Culture that funds the arts or soft power. And frankly, until 2009, I didn't even darken the doorstep of the U.S. Embassy because they weren't doing anything.
Right.
And it's really since 2009 was a turning point, and they've started doing more projects, they've started funding more things. But again, because China doesn't want to fund foreign companies coming over, they want the foreign government to pick up the tab. And because the U.S. doesn't do that, they bring in way more European groups. The Dutch, granted, their funding was just, you know, eviscerated recently, but cultural funding in the Netherlands, they had three pavilions at the Shanghai Expo, one of which was only for performing arts.
Wow.
The U.S. barely made it to have one.
Yeah.
So
we all know that horrible story.
So the Dutch, you know, the European groups, the French embassy has done this annual Croisement, you know, cultural spring festival that's now not only in Beijing, but in cities all over China. The U.S. is much more reliant on a different system. And actually, part of our role is getting China to understand that, because a lot of times the Chinese venues and the Chinese partners want to know, why isn't there more from the U.S. or why won't
what's
the U.S.
do more? What are you doing?
Right, exactly. And there is no Ministry of Culture. The funding system's different. It's corporate sponsorship. It's the NEA doesn't fund as much internationally anymore. It's all funding things within the U.S. So that's a little bit where we come in terms of fulfilling the role that, say, the U.K. is the British Council, Germany is the Goethe Institute, and Ping Pong Productions is trying to step it up for the American side, because it's really lacking.
So what are some of the, let's rattle off some of the cool stuff that you've brought over here to China.
Well, we did bring the Pentagon Papers, LA Theater Works. It was the first American theater company to be at the National Center for the Performing Arts.
Oh, wow.
So National Center's been open since 2008. They've had Israeli, European, U.K., never had an American theater company.
Amazing.
Yep. So
in 5 years, they had not had a single
Well, not a single amazing. American theater. They've had dance and orchestras, but not theater. We brought Mark Morris Dance Group to the Guangzhou Opera House. That was a great one because, again, the lighting designer had, everything was all arranged, all planned, and then at the 11th hour they said, oh, never mind, those things we told you we have, we don't have, and the lighting designer's on his plane redesigning the whole show for the Guangzhou Opera House on the way over here.
And it worked out.
It worked out. It was gorgeous. It was spectacular. It actually worked out better in Guangzhou than it did in Macau. So there are times where it really, you know, they have it together. What other things that we brought over? We didn't bring them over, but we worked on Alvin Ailey American Dance Company when they were here at American Dance Theater in 2004 and 2007. Going in the other direction, we brought the first Chinese dance company to be invited by Lincoln Center Festival in 2012. That was Tao Dance Theater. So we like to work on firsts.
Oh, good, good, good. So, and outside of theater and dance, what other do you anything in symphonies, or I mean, is that something out of your purview?
Not as much for a couple of reasons. One, we don't need to. I mean, a lot of symphonies are there's more Piaofang, there's more ticket sales there, right. So the venues have been doing that on their own, and we can fill a void for more contemporary work and a lot of independent work going out. Things we fill in the gaps where the kind of big dogs,
heavy metal bands in
we'll
your future.
On that. that's our new department.
I have to say,
band,
I mean, the Lunhuaju stepped up with we played at a festival in Germany, and the Lunhuaju paid for it for 60% of the plane fare for everyone except for me, because I'm an American citizen. Of course, they have no business paying for me. But yeah, they're still something at least. Yeah.
Well, in Dresden last December there was a big Year of China in Germany.
That's right. Last year they paid for the metal bands to go. Exactly. Last year the entire bill.
Exactly, and that was the Ministry of Culture. He was so proud of that. The Xio Chu Futuzhang, the director of the European Department at the Ministry.
Alison, what are some good resources for people who want to keep current or contribute or just find out what's on? I mean,
it's the information sharing, as we all know, is a little bit spotty here. So there aren't kind of the centralized places to find out what's on. The venues aren't very good at their own PR and marketing.
Yeah, what's up with that?
but I have to say, I think even though there's a lot more than there ever used to be going on in Beijing or cities like Shanghai, there's not so much that you can't just find it on the usual English language magazines.
Sure. That's Beijing and the Beijinger.
That's Beijing, the Beijinger.
And the City Weekend.
Exactly. They're pretty good at knowing what's going on.
Time Out, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. But the venues, I mean, if you speak Chinese, it's a lot easier. If you speak Chinese, there are plenty of resources. People still do douban, even though that's a little bit guoshe, a little bit out. People still do that for different events.
Sad. I really like douban. Okay, great. I mean, this is very edifying, I hope, certainly for me. Let's move on, Jeremy. Let's go on to recommendations. Let's end with you today, because I think you have a special recommendation. But let's start with our special guest, Alison. Alison, what do you have for us this week?
I would recommend, there's not a lot written in English about contemporary performing arts in China. There is. I have two. I have one to read and one to see.
Okay.
If you want to read in English, there are two great people. Claire Concession, who's a professor at Duke.
Can you spell that surname?
Sure. It is Concession. She's a professor at Duke, and she's written a lot about theater in China. And she's translated Gao Xingjian and Meng Jinghui, and she's terrific. So in terms of theater stuff, read Claire Concession. If dance, and looking at sort of the whole extravaganzas, you know, the virtuosity, the song and dance shows that you see, and how and why that is, and kind of understanding the background rather than just writing it off as schlock, but seeing what the cultural context is. Another professor at University of Michigan, Emily Wilcox, is a great scholar, academe, and dancer herself. So she's another good one to look out for her publications.
So Claire Concession and Emily Wilcox.
Yes, okay. But separate from that, because we're talking about performing arts here, and you can't get that from the page, so get your butt into a theater, and everyone has to see The Red Detachment of Women.
Oh, yeah.
Girls in tights with guns. What's not to like?
In Hainan, no less.
In Hainan, I know. And, well, the National Ballet still does it. They do it every Samba Funujia, every March 8th Women's Day.
It's a great one. I mean, of the eight revolutionary operas, that's got to be up there.
It's spectacular. One of my and frankly, it's innovative. I mean, don't go in
girls
watching
it. Girls in tights with guns. Hey, what man. More can you say? Say no more.
No, it's
fabulous. I have a comic book version of The Red Detachment of Women in English, no less. It's pretty awesome.
I have the same book. I know what you mean. It's very,
you do. You know, yeah. That, you know that one. It's amazing. Amazing. Mm. I mean, back in, it was like published in the 70s. It's really, really cool. It's one of the things that my dad brought back from like his first trip to China. It's a good piece of commie propaganda for the kids.
I don't know the English one. I have the Chinese one that's got the...
So, yeah, you know, go see that.
I miss communism. You
know, taking Tiger Mountain by strategy and all.
I miss communism.
But there's a lot going on. Just go see a lot and don't judge it. Just think about it.
Yeah. I'm gonna go with a non-China related recommendation this week. Actually, you know, it's tangentially related to China. I've been playing with this idea that our paucity of knowledge about the Islamic world prior to September 11th left us just intellectually incapable of dealing with the world that tragic event created. I feel like that same kind of paucity is applicable today in China, although I certainly don't see any kind of September 11th like event in the near future. But and in thinking about Islam myself, I've been reading the works of a writer named, an Iranian American named Reza Aslan, who wrote a great book called How to Win a Cosmic War, in which he really sort of deals with the mind of fundamentalism. And a second really good book it's more recent, which I just finished. It's called No God But God, and it's a popular history of Islam written by somebody who is, you know, very upfront about his own faith in Islam. Fascinating, very well written and clear, extraordinarily clear, the story of Islam from a believer, and very good book. So Reza Aslan. Jeremy, why don't you take us out with your recommendation?
All right, I'm going to recommend something I have recommended before in this podcast, ourfolk.net, this great podcast and website devoted to folk music in China and beyond in the Turkic world by Wei Xiaoshi. And particularly, he is now starting a record label called Taj Records, I think. And they are putting out some very interesting music, including a collaboration between Wu Fei, who I happen to be married to, and Zhu Zhongqing, an 84-year-old man born in Chongqing in 1929.
You were hanging out with him recently in Chengdu,
and
right?
He started in the 50s going around rural areas of Sichuan, learning local folk songs, usually work songs by miners and people who pulled boats and other such professions. And he learnt these songs and then recorded them in his own brain, essentially, before Wikipedia. There was Zhu Lao's brain. So I'm not sure when this stuff is going to actually see light of day on the internet or in records, but when it does, I'll put links up, and it's very good.
So
should be soon.
Do you have a selection to play for our listeners?
Yes, so the song that we'll go out with is the Crab Song, or Pang Xia Ge, or if you'll forgive my terrible, terrible kind of Sichuanese, Pong Hai Go. Pong Hai Go.
Pong Hai Go. Listen to the Pong Hai Go. And thanks, Allison. That was great having you in here. And we look forward to having you again.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah.
Thank you, Allison.
Jeremy, I'll see you next week, man. Listeners, we will see you here. Talk to you next week on the Seneca Podcast.
Seneca
Take care.
Podcast.
Listen to this Pong Hai Go. Ah.
Oh.